Welcome to Conversations with Passion. As you can tell by the music intro, this is a special show. This show is all about the women of power, the women of influence, and the women of purpose. We begin the show with Turbo Jam's Shailene Johnson. We'll hear from Lil McPherson from The Wooden Monkey, Francis Leary of Wired Flair, Jessica Bowden of Teens Now Talk, Laura Lee Burgess from Oxford Learning, and we'll close the show with social media guru Sandy Krakowski. But first, here's your host, Corey Poirier.
Well, welcome to the latest edition of the Conversations with Passion radio show. This week, guys, this time around, our theme, and we're starting to do more theme shows now, but our theme is female leaders. And so I would say 90% of the show is dedicated to the female leaders that that make the world go round, the only exceptions being our regular segments, i.e. our learning forums, and the adventures with Corey, and of course our regular story with John Dunsworth. But we tried to pick a John Dunsworth story that related to family, and so tried to keep at least it close to the theme. So this time around, guys, importance to me of this sort of a theme is that for me personally, I can say that my mother, who was a major influence on my life and made many sacrifices in order to raise me and help me to become the person that I've become and perhaps enjoy any successes I may have had, I just thought it was important to highlight the impact that so many female leaders are making in the world. I have to say that my mother, the traits that I have that people say, you know, oh my God, you multitask. Most men don't multitask. That's definitely a trait that I got from my mother. And of course, there's many men that do multitask, but most people would agree or at least say that that's more inherently a female quality. And likewise with things like building certain type of connections online, or let's say with Facebook, in the way that they connect and socialize. So I really do owe it to my mother for passing along some of those traits to me, because I do believe that they've helped me, you know, either get in touch with my feminine side, I don't mind saying, or even given me maybe some competitive advantages I wouldn't have otherwise, to go along with some of the maybe male traits that I inherently had as well. And so I just thought it was important to dedicate a show to the power of those female leaders and the impact they're making in the world. And, of course, we're going to continue this theme down the road. We're going to do one every now and then, a female-themed leader show, and keep watching for future themes. But I have to say that I shared this message of how I came about the realization of how big of an impact my mother really had and how I got some of these traits from her by being raised by a single mother, mostly, that I wouldn't have got in probably any other way. And I shared it with a national magazine who actually came back and approached me and said they'd love to share the article with their masses, which is a readership of, I believe, about 2 million people. Now, it didn't make it in the last issue because they were filled with content, so I can't promise it'll ever make it in, but just to get to the point where they want to share that story, very powerful stuff. So once again, it just goes to show that my mother continues to have such a big impact on my life. Thank you, Mom, for making it all happen. Have a great day, guys, and thank you again for tuning in to the latest edition of the Conversations with Passion radio show. I hope you enjoy the latest edition.
Shailene Johnson is American physical fitness expert, choreographer, author, and entrepreneur. Shailene is most notable for creating the exercise video system known as Turbo Jam, developed and sold by Beachbody, and has also created other workout systems including Turbo Kick, PO, Hip Hop Hustle, and All Star Presenter Camp. Also, she is the CEO of Powder Blue Productions. Here is part two of the conversation with Shailene Johnson.
You've kind of built, I guess you could say, a fitness empire. And so I'm curious, you know, people can learn from that experience because not everybody gets to walk that path. So if you had any suggestions of maybe some challenges along the way of what you ran into in trying to grow such a large company, and even some things that really worked out that you didn't even expect would, is there any kind of things that stand out?
Yeah, and I read probably much like you, Corey. I read everything I can on personal development. I love listening to interviews like the ones on your show where you're talking with experts and people who have had success, and I study and listen to all of that. Just remember that what applies for someone else might not apply for you. I read from so many experts that, it's really important to hire based on skill, and I just have always believed, and my husband Brett would tell you the same, that the success of our business and the success of our marriage and the success of our relationships is such because we always hired because we really liked the person. Even if they weren't the best candidate from a skill standpoint, from a talent standpoint, if we really liked them and we did a lot of research and we hire slow, fire fast. Hire slow because you want to make sure, is this person the right fit? That's an unwritten benefit for you and everyone who's going to have to work with that person. If it's a really nice, likable, positive attitude kind of person, I'll send you back to school so we can figure out how to give you that skill that you lied about on your resume. You know, like the skills are so far less important to me than your heart and your kindness and your positive attitude. And I really believe that's why we so loved doing what we do. And, to go home at night and go, we've got great people who we would lay our lives down for because we like them so – we like the people who work with us. That would be number one. Number two, I think a really important lesson, I don't remember who told me this, but pay for the outrageously expensive attorney when you need it. You know, when we signed our deal with the infomercial company, we had several different attorneys, but I knew I needed someone who specialized in specifically this, infomercial deals. And when I found him and he was $675 per hour, and we kind of calculated what it was going to take to get that deal done. Brett and I were like, how will we ever pay for this? But it paid us back in dividends, and he's a longtime friend, and I would say that about accountants and attorneys. You know, don't skimp. Don't go with your brother's nephew who just got a law school when it's something really important, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's great advice. And the other side, too, you mentioned the word success, Shalene, a few times, and what I love getting inside the minds of people to see where we kind of differ. Success, I've heard, obviously, as many different definitions as the people are different. So I love to ask everybody, what's your definition of success? How do you define success?
Oh, that's great. Wonderful question. My definition of success is to be in control of my day and my life, so that I am able to live it according to my own priority. And my own priority is my husband and my children. So I am successful when I've created a life that I make those decisions. But each hour I can say, does this honor my family? Does this place my family first? Is this harmful to them or is it indifferent? And for me, that's how I define success. So it's not a dollar sign. It's the ability to make those decisions. It's the opportunity to have that choice. That's how I define success.
That's a great definition. I get to hear a lot of different ones, and that goes right near the top because.
Thank you.
Well, so many people just don't get it. It's for a lot of people it's career first, and I've noticed from a couple of things you said for you it's kind of the exact opposite. You know, build a career around what works for the family, and so many people don't get that.
So, and there's a creative way to do it. You know, it might take a little bit longer, and that's why I think it's so important for people to define their priority, what's really important to you, because if they don't and they just start charging away at their goals, and those are the people who they accomplish so much, they reach all their goals, and they can't figure out why they're so unhappy or they're divorced or their children are don't know who they are or they're rebelling or they're having a lot of problems. And the reason why is because they went after goals that were not aligned properly with their true heartfelt priorities. So, my ego might want me to work more and to put my career first. But at the end of the day, that's not what will make me happy. What will make me happy is when I have a happy relationship and strong, confident, self-sufficient children. And everything else can come second.
And so will they be, I know people hate this question, the word legacy, but will they be your legacy? How you raise them and what happens in that part of your life? Or will Turbo Jam be a part of your legacy or the whole fitness empire be part of the legacy?
I don't know what my legacy would be. I hope, you know, when people ask me, you know, what do you think your purpose is? Why did God put you here? I know the answer to that, and people might think it's fitness, but it's not. I know the reason why I'm here and what wakes me up every day and makes me excited is I like to teach. I like to make complicated things really simple for people, and that's what I enjoy doing. I love doing that with my children. I love doing that with absolutely. Anything that's kind of complicated for me, I want to figure it out and go, oh, I got an easier way to do this. I got a shortcut. I got a Cliff Notes. And sharing that with people will be my legacy. Because you can't jump around the spandex all your life.
Some people will try. I think Richard
I love him.
He's awesome. Well, he's got, again, goes back to that passion, right? He's got so much energy. I found it hard. I don't know if I've ever I found it hard myself, and I noticed other people find it hard to dislike anybody who is positive and has a ton of energy and passion.
Yep.
It gets hard to dislike that person.
It is.
So
true.
It's funny. I said I had just a couple of questions, but I have two more quick little questions. Is that okay with you?
Of course. Heck yeah.
Okay, so just two quick questions. One is you talked about personal development, and that's a big part of my life, as you even noted. So I have to ask the question, who inspires you? How do you still get inspired and you know, in terms of reading and what you listen to? Like, how do you get inspired, and who do you have a couple of people that are your big inspirations?
Yeah. Well, my lifelong mentor has been Brian Tracy, and, you know, I can call him a personal friend, but I want to tell people who are listening that, you know, your strongest mentor doesn't have to be someone that you work with or meet with on a monthly basis. It can be a mentor from afar. And Brian Tracy has been a mentor of mine because at that moment where I realized I've got this passion, but I have no idea how to get myself organized and get focused. I was like a ping pong ball. I set out to figure out how to become focused, and I went to one of his seminars 16, 17 years ago, and that changed my life because it taught me how to focus. That's one-hour seminar from him, and I was like, that's the moment that I learned how to get on the right path to learn these habits. And then I read many, many books. And I've read any personal development book that you can think of, but I always went back to his because they're just simple, basic. Just get rid of the fluff. It's just so common sense, and that's what I needed. And so I've, you know, been a student of his from afar for many, many years, and since that time have, in the last 3 years, become very close with Brian, and we've done a lot of things together, and we do a lot of speaking together, a lot of events, and I consider him a close personal friend because here's why he's an important mentor to me. He espouses the type of things that are important to me in all areas of his life. That he's still married and that he places his wife first and his children first means the world to me. It's not a judgment call. I just can't stand it when I go to one of these seminars or read a book and they're talking about relationships and they're on their seventh marriage. You know, I just think...
Yeah.
It's so phony and fake and all those fake clapping and rah-rah. Just teach me the basics, you know, enough with the fluff. And so that's why he's a mentor that works for me, but I think everyone finds theirs. And in terms of business, people always laugh when I say this, but two people, Suzanne Summers and George Foreman.
Oh,
I love them both because Suzanne Summers, she has spiraled her career into whatever it is she feels like she needs to teach people, whether it's cooking or eating or finding holistic cures to cancer. And, you know, certainly that's controversial, but it's something she's passionate about and she wants to share with people. And that's why, you know, she's worth $100 million. And because her husband is number one. He is her manager, Alan. She mentions him in every single interview, and they do everything together. To me, that makes her a mentor in all areas. I think it's really important you pick a mentor who, you know, you want to be like them in more than one area. And George Foreman, the same thing. I mean, if you've read or listened or watched his life story, again, somebody else who started in the boxing ring but figured out a way to create products and lifestyles that have turned him into a household name in terms of kitchen appliances, and his family comes first. And every interview you listen to him, he says every business deal that he ever looked at, he would go over it with his wife and say, is this good for us? Is this good for our family? Is this good for Georgia and Georgina and George Jr. and George Sr., you know, all the Georges in this family? And I just dig that.
You know what's funny? What I was kind of laughing is I saw George in Boston about 4 years ago, part of the Learning Annex, and I love he talked about going back in the world boxing after, I guess you could say, his first run at a younger age, and he said he asked all the Georges, he just defined all Georges, should I go back out in the road? And they all started pointing their fingers to their mouth like, feed me, like little chicks. He actually visualized it. But the message I took is exactly what you said. Is he actually said the words, I asked the kid, should I go back out on the road? And how many people would never even think about that or never even factor that in? So I agree with you.
Well,
I love that.
You know, we certainly, because of the television aspect of it, we've been approached by even The Biggest Loser and other television shows where they, you know, want to either do something on our family or reality TV. And that would certainly help my brand and help sales and help exposure and help, you know, TVQ, all those things. But Brett and I always say, will this have benefit or detriment to our children? And we know the answer now is detriment. Now, once they're up and out of the house, that's fine. But that's just a pressure that I don't believe is fair to put on children. They didn't ask for it.
Yeah, that's a great point, for sure. And
so
you're right,
I think too many people don't. They value their own ego first. Like, this is an opportunity that will never come again. That might be true, but the opportunity to give your children a safe, peaceful childhood will never come again, and you can make other business opportunities for yourself.
Absolutely. So I said one last question. The last question is about the book. I want to get back to the book because, again, like I said, I'm going to now – it's going to be my next purchase. It'll be my next read. I'm just finishing Deepak Chopra's 7 Spiritual Laws of Success. I don't know if you've ever read that book or not.
Well, why don't you do this? Send an email back to my assistant. We'll send you 10 copies to give away to your listeners.
Are you sure? That'd be amazing.
Of course.
I'd love to do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because we're planning to start running contests anyway, so that would be a perfect fit. And
great.
So my question about the book then, I have to ask you this, because I'm looking at the cover right now, and it says 30 Days to Turbocharged Habits, A Banging Body, and the Life You Deserve. So as you said, you're known a lot for the fitness side. But when you started mentioning about the clear-cut goals and how that and the habits that you create, so my big question is, will the book, if I'm a fitness person, if I'm not into fitness, will I still get all those habits that I can create for my life to change and empower my life? In other words, is the book about more than fitness?
Yeah,
I'm kind of getting that it is. But.
Absolutely, yeah. In fact, in the very first chapter, I say, okay, here's the deal. You might have picked up this book because you know me as a fitness expert, and you want to skip ahead to those chapters where I give you some exercises and talk about some things that will improve your diet. Fine. Go ahead and skip through those chapters. And welcome to buying 10 new books next year to lose weight. Because if you don't read the first chapters where you learn how to do these habits, you'll just keep repeating this cycle. And that was really important to me, to work with a publisher who would understood that I wanted the fitness component of this to be so small. Because that's not what's – if I can teach people the habits, it doesn't matter what diet or what exercise program you fall in love with. They'll all work. And at the same time, you'll learn the habits that will impact all areas of your life. And I started creating that followership or fans of personal development when I started doing just randomly a thing called the 30daypush.com. And all I did was, did it for free, and I just thought, well, every day, it was January 1, I was at home on Facebook, and I said, how many of you, like, if I sent you, like, a quickie little video, I just posted it one a day, every day for 30 days, on how I create my to-do list and how I create my priorities and how I reverse engineer goals and how I figure out what two things I'm supposed to do every day. If I did that over the course of 30 days, you know, how many people would be interested in that? And we had, you know, over 100,000 people sign up the first year. And I've just continued it. And so now every month it's just a free kind of like pay it forward that I do for people. And you just put in your email address and bam, the next day you start getting one little video a day. They're not formal. They're just like me at home with my laptop flipped open, and I just kind of go through it in little bite-sized pieces. So it's really quite manageable for people. And the biggest piece of this is that I teach people how to do it from their phone, because you're on your phone 24/7. So why not have that gadget that's in your pocket, on your hand, in front of you, on your desk? Why not have that be your destination to reach and fulfill all of the goals that you've set for yourself? And so that's what my 30daypush.com, that's what those videos do. They just kind of teach you how to do all that stuff with your phone. You know, you're on it all the time anyways.
Now we take another moment in time with John Dunsworth from his collection Stories 2. Christmas 1.
Nowadays, I enjoy Christmas as a time for friends and family. But as a youngster, that time of year brought a certain dread. I was afraid Santa would find out how bad I was and I'd get stiffed. I was heartsick for weeks before the big day. Oh, those sleep-deprived days of December. My problem, even at a young age, is that I suffer from accurate self-esteem. I knew I was a sinner. I pinched things, peeked at gentle toast and mammaries in the National Geographic, and peed outdoors. My letters to Santa were rewritten over and over to get just the right tone, my black heart thumping as I wrote, "I've been good." Even though we had a large family, I was never stinted at Christmas. My mother took care of that. My father was always in a terrible mood, seeing all that money spent on stacks of presents piled on the armchairs and sofas in the living room. Everyone's name printed on pieces of decorated paper ensured no one would be missed. One Christmas, my father put two pieces of coal in my brother Ed's in my stockings. A cautionary reminder to quit our damn bickering, I suppose. They weren't your standard lumps of coal, but two charcoal briquettes he picked up somewhere. Neither my brother nor I had seen the coal in that form before, so we took them for some new design of hockey puck. There we were, in McLean's driveway, passing these wondrous new inventions back and forth, when my dad came out to warm up the car to drive the family to the dreaded Yuletide service. Suspecting that Santa was really my father, I said, "Look what we got!" And to accentuate my thrilling good fortune, launched a wicked slap shot at the garage door. As my hockey stick made contact, the briquette smashed into dust, and my father laughed himself into a bit of a fit. I think we made his Christmas a little brighter that year. I remember at a young age overhearing him as he was leaving for work ask my mum if she'd picked up the BIBLE for the kids. Always afraid to search for presents, lest I hoogee myself, this was too good to ignore. At noon, when I got home for lunch, I phoned the several toy stores in the area. "Do you have a Bibble?" I asked each establishment. "I think it's a new toy," I added. No one knew of such a thing. That night, an idea struck me in one of those existential leaps, and the following day, I phoned the stores again. I disguised my voice. "Do you carry any Biblies?" I asked. Surely, B-I-B-L-E spelled Bibly, not Bibble. Again, the negative responses. The anticipation of this existing new toy filled my noggin nightly as I tossed and turned. I figured my parents were augmenting Mr. Claus's generosity with a special treat for us kids. My imagination ran wild. If it was a game, I'd be the best. If it was a toy, I'd get to play with it first. What a heady time for little Johnny Dumbort. Never able to sleep on Christmas Eve, it was my custom to arise in the small hours and sneak into the living room and inspect the plunder. I imagined the BIBLE would be rather large. It was nowhere to be seen. Just the gifts marked to so-and-so from Santa. I had a goodly pile and went back to bed, assuming the blessed present from my parents would be added before our hoard descended. In due time, 10 greedy little children swarmed from aloft. Our big stuffed chairs were emptied, presents spirited away to our rooms, save for games or candies or such. I didn't ask about the BIBLE. I didn't want to expose my snivelness. It wasn't till Christmas night, when we were singing carols en famille, that my father presented we children with a fully illustrated Bible for children. You can imagine how thrilled I was.
Little McPherson, the founder of the Wooden Monkey and a passionate advocate of global sustainability and the environment. Here is part two of the conversation with Little McPherson.
Welcome to the Conversations with Fashion radio show. Thank you for joining us today. And I'm going to start things off by jumping right into the sustainability side of things, because I know that's a passion area for you.
Yep.
So
maybe you can tell me a bit about your background, about how you got into this whole world of sustainability and organic, and how that all takes place.
Well, I guess it's been going on for a long time. It's probably been a seed in me probably since I was a little girl. I was trying to think back of actually where my passion actually started. And I think it was around when I was 12 years old. I started to hear about acid rain. And I was floored. It actually scared me as a little girl. And I went to school and I asked about, you know, what's going on with this acid falling from the sky in the rain, you know, and I asked my parents who didn't care or know, you know, and the teacher said to me, well, it's something about pollution coming up with kind of a tailpipe from, you know, the North American pollution. It comes up and it gets caught in the sky and, you know, it comes down and it rains on us. And it's, you know, causing, things to decay. And I was like, what? And it scared the crap out of me. And I said, well, what are you going to do about it? Like, you're going to do something, right, about this acid coming from the sky. And she said, well, there's nothing really we can do. So I think right at that moment, I felt really hopeless and helpless as being a little girl. And it really bothered me because I really loved the rain. I used to wash my hair in the rain. And at that moment, I thought, boy, this earth needs protecting. Somebody has to do something. When I'm a grown-up and someone comes up to me and talks, you know, asks about acid rain, I'm going to have something to say. I'm going to help them. I think it's at that moment, that was it.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
It's an acid rain thing. It's a, you know, and the first time it started to rain after I had the conversation, I was sticking my head out, and I was like, this is weird. Like, do I stick my head out? Is my hair going to fall off? And it was a really weird thing.
You're almost scared
to
walk.
I was 12, and then I go to now, doing talks to young kids, to schools, and I look at them and they're fearful. And that's where the whole thing comes in.
Wow. So it's full circle almost.
Totally full circle.
And it's funny when you say that. I didn't make the connection as a kid about the when I was in school, one of my teachers brought up global warming and the ozone layer and all this stuff. And I remember in the class, we were all just like, throwing papers at each other. Like, it didn't even register to us. We're just thinking, this guy's talking about something that's like from the movie 1984.
Right. It's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen. It doesn't exist.
I don't see it.
And it's so wild to me because he's the only teacher that ever brought it up in my whole high school, quote-unquote, life. And you know, now it's something forefront that we talk about regularly. If you listen to, you know, say talk radio, they talk about how we have to start fixing things, about how we recycle and all this. And it's so weird to me that I didn't clue in at that point. But now, like you said about that full circle, I always remember that teacher talking about it. And so it's weird because it's one of the few things I remember that I wish I would have taken more seriously. And I could even go back to and visualize him taking this into a greenhouse and talking about it in grade 11. And we were just all like, what's this guy on?
Oh, yeah. No, the kids are ready. They are so hungry and so upset. And, I mean, I'm talking to some, talk about passionate. I'm, you know, the 20-year-olds that I talk to that are so full of passion and so, you know, and they're upset, they're mad, they're like, we want action, we want, you know, and as an adult and as a mom, I'm always talking about as a mom because it's like, I, you know, my kids are being threatened by the future, and it's serious, it's real. We are on a global crisis right now in every level when it comes to food and water and air, and to me, mine's food. The basket is food for me.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the biggest things we can do to combat climate change is decide, I know, on what we eat. That's very powerful. I mean, people don't realize, and what I want to go and what I've been doing and teaching people about the two food systems, what's going on. You know, the organic food system, to me, people ask me all the time, what is organic food? And I simply say, I would simply say, organic food is what we've been eating and growing since the beginning of time. And if you believe in Jesus Christ or Buddha, whoever you believe in, they ate organic food. And it's so far removed from that. We had to rename that food and call it organic because the other food is so altered and, you know, full of pesticides and GMOs, and it's really altered food. So that's where that whole story came in. So it's just food.
It's funny, you have to explain what just food is.
Exactly. And people say, you know, I got in an argument or a great discussion on someone that was defending GMOs and saying, well, organic is a fad. I said, okay, organic is not the fad. It's the industrial food system was an awful, destructive, unsustainable fad that we just went through. Holy crap. It's not good for our bodies, our environment, our water, our air, our community, our business, the farmers. There's not one great ripple effect except for the top of the food chain, like the Cargills, the Monsantos. Those people are winning. And no wonder we're so sick. You know, I mean, it's just, the food box is massive, huge.
It's the money saver is the only part. Like on the business side, they feel they're saving money in the short term.
Absolutely in the short term. And you know what, when you and it's actually not the cheaper food system. I mean, you know, we're definitely paying for that cheap food because we're paying it environmental costs.
And
healthcare. And I'd rather pay a farm than just in the hospital, actually. You know, and people say organic food's expensive. I say so is cancer. So
yeah.
We're in a crossroads. We're at a tipping point with food. And the monkey was born because of a hurricane. The hurricane, you know, Juan came through here, scared the crap out of me. I actually wasn't here for it. I flew over it the next day. I couldn't come home because of the hurricane.
Okay.
From Vancouver. And I flew over it, and it horrified me. I was like, wow, what the hell just came through our province? And I knew in my gut it was a climate change hurricane. I knew. And I'm also a climate change presenter, and I know you just interviewed Dave Suzuki, who I listened to. I've been with a camp with him 3 times.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah, as an Al Gore presenter. And Dave Suzuki's always with at those camps, and it was an incredible training, you know. So, you know, so my journey basically is to, you know, is to teach people on show them the way. You know, when you talk about, you know, like when I was first approached to be a presenter on climate change, I was like, I can't do that. I was doing a little monkey talk. This
yeah.
is what I'm doing, la, la, la. You know, the hurricane scared me. I want to get a new food system for Nova Scotia because after the hurricane, I was asking people, wondering how we are doing actually, you know, sustainable. How is the province doing? You know, we're almost an island. We're up north. Do we have any food, you know, storage situations? What's our situation here, you know? And the answers were horrifying. They were scary. People don't realize, you know, if we get cut off for the rest of the world, look at 9/11, you know, things can happen, especially now. We've got about 3 days of food left. And people have no idea. And, you know, so I'm like, okay, what happened? Why that happened? You know, just the whole thing. And I said, well, we need our systems back. We need to fight for the farmers. We're going to need them desperately. You know, we don't have a choice here. We really don't. And it's a great way. I'm like, come the green way. It tastes better. It's happier. It's cleaner. You know, there's more local economy building. It's just the ripple effect is so freaking good.
The Learning Forum.
Hey guys. Here we are back with this week's Learning Forum. Just wanted to share what I felt was a very powerful message that came from a situation that occurred at last week's International Business Trade Show, the one we've been promoting on the radio show recently with our interviews with the trade show founder, Nikki Jafari. And the trade show, I thought, went off without a hitch. Great, fantastic experience for most involved, I would say, if not all involved. But one of the messages that I've shared in the past in my seminars and speaking engagements, what have you, it came to the forefront once again for me to experience firsthand and perhaps share it with you at the trade show. So I had a booth and I had a draw box. And even though a ton of people came by the booths and stopped to say hi and a lot of great interactions were made, nobody was putting their card in the draw box. And so around 2:00 in the afternoon, the booth holder that was next to me, the lady at the booth holder, decided to put her name in for the draw. And her card, and we got a picture of this as well, I'm going to put up on Facebook soon, her card was the only card in the little draw box right until roughly 4:00 in a trade show that finishes at 5:00. And it was joined by 2 more cards from 4 to 5, but only because it was people that we knew and had shared the story about the fact that hers was the only card, and so they put it in so that they could be in on the draw as well. And what I decided is, since there was only 3 cards in the draw, I gave everybody a prize. So what I found kind of cool, and the message you can take from that, is until 4:00, and if we wouldn't have shared the story with the 2 other people that put their cards in, the lady who put her card in was the only person in on the draw. So what's the lesson here? Sometimes just showing up puts you in a position that nobody else is in and increases your odds by, well, in this case, as much as 100% that you're going to be the person that gets to your goal. So if her goal was to win the prize, and if we wouldn't have told the story to those 2 other people, and even if we stopped the trade show at 4:00, a whole day trade show, she had 100% chance of winning and achieving her goal simply by showing up. What a powerful message.
Up next, we have Francis Leary, owner of Halifax-based business Wired Flare, marketing company focused on helping you stand out from your competition online. Wired Flare was also recently announced as a finalist for the New Business of the Year in the 2013 Halifax Chamber of Commerce Business Awards. Here is Francis Leary.
I have to say, the folklore side of your business is what drew me in immediately, and maybe it's because, you know, in the world of social media and social marketing, I hate to say it, but we hear a lot of the people's backstories that they tend to sound somewhat similar. And yours, when I read the folklore, of course, we had you profiled in one of our books, and when I read your story about the folklore, it just, there was something about it that spoke to me that said, wow, this is such a unique approach to the whole idea of communities. And like you say, and in terms of how people communicate and how they brand and market themselves, I just love that whole approach and philosophy, and it made it so much different. So it's kind of funny how we see it often where somebody's background, whether unique or not, eventually the tale comes out that it actually was what led them to who they became today and what made them different. And so I think it's so cool that you have that background, because I think it's a part of probably what makes you unique as an online marketer today. Would you agree with that? The folklore?
Absolutely. I think the folklore background that I have has really led to the development of our marketing approach at Wired Flare. I mean, everything is about investigating and incorporating as many worldviews as we can. So it's not about one view or one idea. It's about, you know, how many different ideas can we put together to really serve our clients and their audiences, and how can we communicate effectively doing that? I mean, the world of social media is all about exchanging worldviews. And not only can we do it with our neighbors across the street now, but we can exchange worldviews with people literally across the globe. And now companies have the opportunity to harness that and to use it to their advantage and actually connect with people in a real way by engaging with these multiple worldviews all around.
Yeah, I have to say, and maybe it's part of a question as well, but I kind of suspect that I'm not alone in this, but it took me a lot longer time to warm up to social media than what I see the average person warming up to. So in other words, what I see as the average, I think I was on the slow side of warming up to it compared to everybody else. Now I'm just kind of coming around to seeing how it's so I want to say holistic and grassroots in terms of now how people can get so engaged in things in a way they couldn't before. So in other words, we were talking to somebody yesterday who is in the film business, and how on the social media side, bringing together a film project by having the component of the social media and asking people, what would you like to see in this movie, or how would you, you know, what do you think would be the proper way to do this? All of a sudden, the people that are responding are now actually a part of creating that movie, and that's something that could never have existed without social media. And so I'm just starting to see that, or even the idea that we can now finally kind of choose what we tune out and what we tune in terms of our own news. You know, all of a sudden social media becomes our own talk radio, and we actually get to decide who we add as friends, so we get to decide whose messages we want to hear. So I'm kind of, a late adopter, but would you say that that is the norm, or would you say majority of people kind of got it right away and jumped right on board?
Well, I definitely think that initially there was sort of a slow uptake. I mean, it was so many people just, there was no knowledge initially of how powerful this could be, certainly for business growth. It was just fun, you know, people connecting with high school friends they haven't seen in 20 years, and, you know, grandmas being able to see their grandchildren born when they're not right there. Just really personal experiences. And in the past several years is when I think people really started to realize that, wow, this is a really powerful business tool. And, I mean, companies are realizing more and more that in order to grow an effective organization, you have to do business with people, right? It's all about people connecting with people. And social media makes that happen so much more easily and on such a broader scale. So I think there are still those resistant businesses out there that aren't quite sure how they can use social media. They're a little bit scared of it. You know, they really don't want to hear, you know, what your child did at school that day. And, you know, I totally get that. Sometimes it can be a little bit personal. The reality is, though, that every business can benefit from social media. It just depends on finding the right one. Like, not every business will succeed as much on Facebook or on Twitter or on LinkedIn or on Pinterest or on Google Plus. They have to find where their audience is and then make that commitment to be there.
Coming up next, Corey chats with Jessica Bowden, CEO of Teens Now Talk magazine, the Halifax-based quarterly magazine written by teens for teens. When you give the youth a voice, you give the future a chance. Here is a conversation with Jessica Bowden.
Well, Teens Now Talk is a publication that's written by teens for teens here in Atlantic Canada. The purpose behind it mainly came from a large school assembly of about 900 students, and I was a guest speaker, and they asked the key questions of, I simply asked them what's their issues. They know who I am, they know what I do, but by having me in front of you as a group of students, it's not really helping you excel. So I wanted to find out what actually is the issue, because you hear so much, and no one asks the questions. And the place erupted, and it was almost like I called it a chicken farm, because you couldn't hear anything but just chatter everywhere. And I broke the class into groups of 50, took them into their own little rooms, and said, if I can't hear you, the world can't hear you. So we need to clear your voice. We need to make sure you have a powerful voice and have a powerful platform to stand on. Go out, find me one solution, come back with a solution. The issue and the solution. And about a half hour later, they came back into the gym. We reconvened, so to speak. We read each individual group's issue and what they feel is the top solution. And then I said, now I have the information. What am I going to do with it? And one youth said, we should write a book. Another youth said, we should call it TNT, Our Words Are the Bomb. And I went from being the keynote speaker to being the receptionist, secretary, writing down all the information, and told them I'll come back in 2 weeks with a concept. And that's what I did. I came back in 2 weeks. The gymnasium was packed again. I explained to them, I'm not going to do a book. I will do a magazine, and I will call it Teens Now Talk instead of TNT. And that's how it basically started. And we had about 200 youth at that particular assembly, join on. And I still have those youth today, not all 200, close to maybe 50 of those youth still today are a part of the Teens Now Talk. The rest have moved on as they grow up. They now become young men and women, and I get the younger ones coming in. So it's just a revolving door of youth sharing their words through the magazine.
Wow. Very, very cool. And so I guess in starting it, Jessica, then, if you had to kind of pick what are the things that surprised you the most, because obviously you're going into unknown territory, so what perhaps surprised you the most about that experience, or about the experience thus far?
What I believe, well, not believe, I know, what one of the key things that surprised me the most was the fact that the youth have so much solutions, so many solutions, that no one is listening to them. No one, and I mean that in a vague, well, I shouldn't even say vague. I mean that directly, because they say it every day. They live out their issues every day. And they feel that because they are teens, no one takes them serious. So that was one of the key things I felt that had to be really addressed in the magazine. And by doing so, I made the teens the journalists. I made the teens the ones that do the columns. I placed them in a position so they have the voice. And all this also came up with our tagline, which is be seen, be heard, be the voice. So based on that, just one issue came that tagline, because teens, adults, I always say adults think teens are going through a stage. They break up with the boyfriend. They get attitude adjustment changes. They go through all these little things growing up as they try to carve out their life to be a teen to an adult. And an adult sees it as, oh, they're only going through a stage. Where in fact, teens really want to be on stage. They want to be heard. They want to be seen, and they want to have a voice. So from that whole structure and that one issue, this whole thing came out. another key thing that was very important was that teens do have a lot of creativity, but they feel they can't show it until they get to a certain age because no one's going to validate it for them. They feel, well, you know, I want to do this, but I have to wait until I get older in order to get myself recognized, which we also addressed in that issue of the magazines. And the third key thing for me was the fact that we have a lot of youth that are living in constant fear, pain, stress, anxieties, and just don't know where to go or who to speak with without feeling alienated or feeling naive and stupid, as they call it, or looking different. So this way, I have a lot of those youth that are going through those issues or situations that write columns in the magazine. So they're sharing their viewpoints. They do research. They get the proper information themselves, and they're also sharing it with the other youth. So therefore, when the youth sees that in the magazine, they then see this person who they wouldn't even give a time of day to speak to now be published in a magazine, which then turns that whole energy into more of a positive, we call it positive bragging rights, where then they walk down the hall in their school, their friends are saying, good job, Jeannie, it's all your issue. Teachers are saying, congratulations, it's all your issue. Jeannie's self-esteem is now building. The students are now reading what Jeannie had written. They're getting more knowledge, and everybody else, the people are now starting to connect. So we're kind of knocking the knees out of all that negativity and weighing the scales to balance out between that positive and negative.
When we hear the second part of that interview, we'll be delving deeper into the publication and what it has done for the teens involved over the years. Up next, we have local education entrepreneur Laurelee Burgess, director of the Oxford Learning Centers in the Halifax and surrounding area. Laurelee is passionate about helping children succeed and believes that all children have the potential to excel when they believe in themselves. Here is part one of the conversation with Laurelee Burgess.
If you are applying for a job and have a poorly written cover letter, you won't get that opportunity to sit in front of that employer to say, I am great for this job, because they have judged you based on your writing. The same thing goes with a job application. You know, if there's spelling mistakes on a job application, chances are you won't make it past that step. So those are skills that are really important that I feel that we're not focusing enough on these days. We're really relying on things like email and spell check, but that doesn't teach people the mechanics of writing. It doesn't teach you how to be a good writer.
Or Twitter. We're relying on Twitter as our spell check.
Yeah.
Our work. It didn't say it was wrong.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, and God bless technology, but it's so funny when you think about it. Twitter is almost they should get like an award for the company that's been most successfully able to bring the people away from learning basic spelling skills, because they tell you 140 characters or less.
Right.
So you're automatically told, well, I got to put the letter R. People know what that means, so I'm okay. But then you don't learn to spell a lot of words that you would otherwise learn to spell.
Right.
And I hate admitting this, but at the same time, I don't mind admitting it, because I think people learn from us sharing our stories. But whenever I finished, well, I'll say it two ways. I finished high school. One of my courses, I haven't shared this many times, one of my courses, a teacher actually gave me a 49. Now, 50 was a pass.
Right.
49 plus one. And that was my graduating year. So, and I needed that course. It was a requirement.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually graduated high school with a gimme point.
Oh, wow.
And I mean, I never failed a grade, but I mean, and I did. I wasn't at that stage where they were kind of just pushing you through.
Right.
Obviously. Or he wouldn't have given me 49 plus 1. He would have just given me 50.
Right.
Or 55 or something. But it was, I always remember that. It was a big, again, allowed
to
fail.
Message, right?
Oh, it sent a big message that I barely passed. But the funny part to me is I'm now, as you know, writing newspapers, editing newspapers, writing books. And I have to be honest with you, Laurelee, I graduated high school without basic grammar skills. I didn't know the difference between the theirs, like ownership. I didn't know the difference between your and your are. You are.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I didn't know all that. I learned it by doing.
Right.
So I had, as an adult learner, I had to learn all over again, almost.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, again, quite a few generations ago, so it kind of scares me as to what's happening now. So, again, it brings me to another point, is we hear all these things like, I just sent out a survey from the client, Dartmouth Learning Network. Mm-hmm. They put a survey out for businesses to try to figure out where literacy is at in their offices.
Mm-hmm.
And they said they've done a study before this that said, they did a study that said 48% of today's average employees is below an acceptable level by their employer,
mm-hmm.
what we consider an acceptable level to function as part of their job. So I guess my question is, we hear that people are having challenges whenever we do the aptitude tests in Canada. You know, we hear challenges all the time that we're below average. What do you attribute all that to? Because you get to see it on the inside out. So what do you feel is the reason that it keeps, instead of going up, it's going down in terms of what we're hearing at least?
Right. Well, I mean, my opinion is that class sizes are huge these days. There's a lot of, we've integrated so many different learning styles into a classroom. So teachers are faced with large classes, varying levels of learners within that class that they are expected to help those students meet the outcomes, just as everyone else. I think there's a lot of content jammed into every year. I think, which may not necessarily be the popular stance, but I think that a lot of what we're doing in school right now is content-based. You know, we're covering a lot of topics, but not necessarily a lot of skills. You know, I would really like to see more of the basics, you know, getting back to teaching kids math from the beginning. You know, instead of constantly reinventing the wheel, and I feel like that's what's going on a lot right now, is that education is in a bit of a flux. You know, things aren't really working. We're seeing the results that aren't what we'd like to see, so we're changing it. And I think that's challenging for teachers. I think it's challenging for parents to say, well, now what should I expect out of school? But there's a lot that goes on in the run of a day, and I feel that teachers are doing a lot more maybe behavior management than necessarily teaching. And so it's the system. You know, I think that there's definitely changes, and there's been a lot of discussion, especially, you know, the beginning of this school year, about class sizes and budgets and budget cuts and all these sorts of things. And I don't think throwing money at the problem is the answer. I feel like we need to go back to the basics. I feel like we're trying so many different things right now, but if we just taught kids how to add and subtract and multiply and divide and do fractions and decimals, math, everything else is built on that. You know, they would be able to think, they would be able to figure things out, and it's, mm-hmm. and math is the example I use, but I mean, it applies to everything. So it's, I think that it's really about so many things, so many pieces.
So not to put you on the spot, but I think this is probably a good kind of big near-the-end question, but I have to ask you this one, because and I'm talking out loud because I'm watching this from the outside in, and to be perfectly honest, and you know, I shouldn't be this honest, but it doesn't really impact me personally in a negative way, and in fact, it only impacts me in a positive way because I'm competing with these people for contracts and things like that, and so, you know, you wouldn't think I care as much as I do, but I truly do because I believe in learning, and I learned how, I didn't read my first book, I think I've shared with you, until I was 27,
mm-hmm.
so I'm an adult learner completely. I started from scratch almost when I was in my adult years, and so I understand it, and I believe the power of learning completely, and it kind of discourages me when I hear some of the things I hear. So, you know, what you summarized, I agree with completely in terms of what I'm seeing that are some of the issues, i.e. Growing population. Well, you know, we have in terms of student population, like behavioral problems, which sometimes could be due to technology. You know, are we allowed to let them use their cell phones? How do we take it away from their parents? Get mad at us if we ask them to get rid of their cell phone. Then we have the parent situation where parents seem to be intervening a lot. There seems to be a sense of entitlement. There's a whole lot of issues that seem to be going on. And then, like you say, a lot of content, but if you don't grasp the content, we'll just push you through anyway because we're not allowed to get mad at you or hold you back. So seeing all those things happen, and I think we're in as a society, we're going through a real growing pain right now with everything, like technology. I mean, we're seeing, I think you and I talked about, Blockbusters of the world disappear and music stores disappear. And we're seeing a whole shift in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So my big question is, do you think we're going to have to hit rock bottom to start saying we got to fix the system? because there's so many things going on that it's almost like you said, people are throwing their hands up in the air and say, well, let's try this then. Well, let's try this then. But maybe it's a matter of overhauling and starting again from scratch. Do you think we're going to have, because I'm seeing with the other side, the technology side, mm-hmm. where we're going to actually have to hit a certain point where we say, oh, my God, we've dropped the ball.
Right.
Do you feel that we're going to have to hit that plateau, or do you think that we're just going to keep on going and it'll work itself out?
We'll leave that question as a teaser for the next one, but in part two of the interview with Laura Lee, we will dig in much deeper, discuss the challenge of technology, how parents can help to prepare their children, and why the traditional education system seems to be having more than its fair share of challenges.
Adventures with Corey.
Welcome, guys, to this edition of the Adventures with Corey. I just want to share a really quick story this time around about a recent experience I had. I attended the Vinyl Cafe taping, so the radio show, The Vinyl Cafe, that appears on CBC Radio. I attended the taping that took place recently at the Rebecca Cohen Theater, if you're familiar with that great venue. And during Stuart McLean, who is the, I guess, the co-creator of the show and the voice that we all hear when we listen to the show, Stuart was on stage doing an impromptu Q&A, and people from the audience were asking questions. And the very last question that took place was a little voice from the audience who asked Stuart a question. And Stuart said, sure, go ahead and ask your question. And the question that he asked was, can I come up on the stage with you? And Stuart took a peek down and looked at the owner of the little voice and said, sure, come on up on the stage. And within seconds, 5-year-old Malachi made his way up on stage and shared a very memorable 10 minutes with Stuart. And, of course, Stuart, the definite owner of that stage, was perfect. You'd almost swear it was scripted, even though it was completely in the moment. And at one point, to give you an example of how cool it was, is that Malachi asked Stuart if he could ask him a question, and Stuart said, sure. And he said, I want to give you something. Is that okay? Stuart said, yes. And Malachi reached into his pocket, grabbed 2 quarters, and pulled them out and gave them to Stuart. And Stuart handed one back as if on cue and said, you know what, how about you keep one and I'll keep one, and this way we'll both remember this moment forever. The coolest part to me, well, I guess the two coolest parts, first of all, backstage Stuart shared that that was one of two moments that he'll never, ever forget. He talked about having many, many memorable moments during the show's history, but how that was one of those ones that'll just never leave his, it's just a special moment that'll never leave his memory. And but what he shared from the stage with Malachi during the interaction was when Malachi made his way back to his seat, he said, I want to share a lesson with you, Malachi. The fact that you asked if you could come up on stage and I said yes, he said, I want you to realize how powerful that that lesson is to you and other people, is that never be afraid to ask for something, because you'll be surprised how often someone will say yes. So what I want to share with you is that people ask me all the time how I may have done this or achieved this or reached this person. More often than not, it was simply the power of asking. And so, again, I can agree with Stuart and say that when you ask more than the next person for the things you're looking for, you'll be surprised how often people will say yes. Obviously, use that advice with caution, but this is the this episode's Adventures with Corey, and I hope you can apply that lesson throughout your life and career. Thank you so much.
Sandy Krakowski is a serial entrepreneur who refers to herself as a happy entrepreneur. She has 11 successful companies under her belt and is a back-to-basics, step-by-step business expert who currently serves more than 170,000 clients in over 136 countries. Here is social media guru, Sandy Krakowski.
Thank you so much, Sandy, for joining us on the Conversations with Passion radio show. And maybe I'll start by getting you to tell our listeners a bit about your story and how you got into the world of e-commerce and social media.
Sure, that'd be awesome.
Very cool. So yeah, so how did it all begin?
Well, one of the things, social media has only been around as far as that I've been using has been since 2009. And so I know it started maybe a little bit before then. I came online in the 90s. and started my very first kitchenware business purely on a desire to be able to get the products that I wanted at wholesale. Very interesting.
Very cool.
Business model, eh? A lot of people say to me they got started in a business because they wanted time freedom, financial freedom, they want to be with their kids. Some of the mission statements and desires that I get when they first start out are so long, I think, oh, my gosh, something must be wrong with me, because I merely wanted my stuff that I wanted in my kitchenware at wholesale. My husband was working at General Motors, and it was like, you know, $900 to get kitchen mixers and Blendtec blenders, and I had about $5,000 worth of kitchenware I was dreaming about. And I didn't even know if Santa Claus was going to bring that at Christmas. And so I figured, I bet you there's a certain amount I could sell and then get them for wholesale. I was publishing a newsletter, the good old-fashioned direct mail way. I invited the ladies who were reading our offline newsletter back then online. And, I mean, I was using, I think it was a Pentium 1 at that time, you know, where that had Netscape with the eye that rotated, and we all thought it was the mark of the beast, you know. And, I mean, it was hysterical. And I said, why don't we go online? And I created what I thought was a website. Oh, my gosh, that you can actually still see it in archive.org. And it was atrocious. And I told people that I was going to be selling a certain amount of kitchenware, and I was willing to take orders, and I was going to throw in a free cookbook and some free cooking things, because I calculated I could give away a few free things, maybe that'll work, and free shipping, I said, and we did an $8,000 order. I not only got almost all of what I wanted for free, but I got bit with a bug that has not left me since. And how I got onto social media, it's hysterical again. My plan wasn't, oh, my gosh, look at this platform. We can connect with everybody all over the world. No, at first I looked at social media and thought, what the heck are they doing? Why are they telling everyone what they eat? I don't care what the flip you eat. I mean, why are they posting all this personal stuff all over Facebook and Twitter? Twitter looks like a bunch of text messages. Why are people doing this all day? What a waste of time. I mean, I'm challenge-driven, and I'm thinking, you know, shut that down and go back to work if you want to make money. There's my business 101 tip for all you social media experts. And yet, I began to see some results. I would be doing a copywriting project for a company, and I'd say, you know, just got done writing an email series and, you know, was able to make a client over $89,000 with just two emails, and I love what I do. And all of a sudden I'd get DMs, mind you, on my personal profile. Can you write emails for me? And I'm thinking, what? Is this how this thing works? And so so I later, you know, I started doing what everybody does. I played around with my profile, built it up to 5,000 friends, and started taking the typical response of, you know, you shouldn't be doing this on your personal profile, and why are you selling me? Why? Some people were still interested in what I was doing. And I later decided to start a business page when I got serious about it, because I figured if you're really going to use social media for business, for crying out loud, you should represent yourself as a business. And things grew very, very quickly. Obviously, we were just recently featured in Forbes and how we grew our page from like 10,000 to 110,000 in a year. As a matter of fact, in the last 10 days, we've had 10,000 people join us on our Facebook page. But, you know, initially, again, my whole, yay, let's go use social media. I was really opposed to social media. I thought it was a waste of time. And now I absolutely love it, because it is the place where our clients here in the world are connecting. It is where people are seeking relationship, and they are seeking out brands and connection with people that are real. It's actually, you know, God has changed my whole heart towards social media, because there are real people behind every face, behind every profile and every story, and it's a delight to be able to serve them, connect with them real time, hear how we can better ourselves and where they are and how we can serve them in that. So I guess you could say Sandy Krakowski has a history of not building business plans, as most people do, and really just being herself out of the box. I'm sure you're shocked at that. But that's seriously how I got started in business.
No, that's
very cool, and it doesn't surprise me because I am on the Facebook page, and that's how I discovered you a while back, and also I've seen the message come out about Forbes, so I was really excited about that as well. And
thank you.
You were mentioning about the unconventional ways that businesses start, and whether a person's a fan of the movies he makes or not, I remember reading that Quentin Tarantino made Pulp Fiction to get enough money to pave his driveway.
You get what I'm saying? I mean, sometimes, I think many times, and this is a, here's a neat business coaching tip for anybody listening. A lot of times we have this false belief that very successful people got started in things because they were very strategic from the beginning, and they were very tactical with their plans. And yet, the success stories that I hear, even the billionaires that I've had the privilege to meet, and the people that are very close friends of mine have been very successful, whether it's athletically, whether it's with a ministry or a business or in raising 13 kids, whatever you want to call success, because I think it applies to all of them. They all were driven with this passion and maybe even this uniqueness about them that they basically just jumped in. I mean, you don't ever hear of an Olympic athlete who says, yes, at 2 years old, I saw myself being an Olympic athlete. Usually they're like, I used to get in trouble all the time because I wasn't doing my math, or at two, they're not doing math, but I wasn't doing what I should have done, and I always wanted to do this. And later in grade school, I wasn't doing what I should have done, but I was always getting caught with this. Well, obviously, I'm not recommending that we not do the things we should be doing, but I think it's very important to see so many people were being driven and steered by their passion and the thing that they love and the thing that I say God wrote in their DNA when they were in their mama's womb. I believe it was a gift that God sends from heaven to us here on earth. And for us business owners, it's an awesome thing when it starts coming through business. And so from what I have discovered and the successful people that I have met in my lifetime and then experienced in my own life, it wasn't this big tactical strategy plan. Certainly that has to come in, because passion can also cause you to drive yourself into a brick wall. I mean, passion and the things you're obsessed about and can become your addiction if you're not careful. But it certainly is the thing that really causes us to go in a way that makes the mastery come into play in our life as we pursue it.
That's very cool that you mentioned that about what you've discovered. I've interviewed at this point, we're over 2,200 people now.
Right,
and
on.
I have to.
Good job.
Yeah, it's been a lot
Do
of fun.
Do you like to interview people? I think that's so fun.
It's, you know what, I'm probably a little bit obsessed by it.
And, great. Stop apologizing. All proteges have an obsession. And I personally believe that I've learned from someone I respect very much, Stephen Furtick, is that your thing that you're obsessed and passionate about is usually the thing God wants to use in the earth. A little bit of good grooming and training, and, you know, everyone can benefit from it. So please, Corey, don't stop interviewing people.
You know what? I don't think I could if I wanted to now. But it's interesting what you just mentioned about your discovery, and it's been my discovery as well, is that the people that have achieved the highest levels weren't, let's say, crystal clear, completely focused 100% on that when they set out. They were flexible to changes that might occur, but also what you had mentioned about the fact that they were following their passion, and it was kind of leading the way. And
yeah,
it's kind of
yeah.
neat how you discover that it's not about that person, you know, those people that say, when I'm 2 years old, I want to be a fireman. You know,
yeah.
it's not always, doesn't always have to be that way, which is kind
of
neat.
I have one of those in my house who wanted
oh,
to
really?
Be a fireman, who it's so funny, and he would say to me after he's, you know, I've homeschooled him, he now runs our billing department, he loves to go all over the world and impact young kids, he leads worship, he just basically recently got himself an amazing Gresh, like, Falcon, which is a beautiful guitar, but he was like, well, I love to fix things, and I want to be a fireman. And what does that mean? And it was funny because I said, I really think you're designed to release fire, Justin. And you're also designed to put fire out, because wherever he goes, he's very motivational and he encourages people and everything's, you know, has its particular place. He loves to work out, but he's also the kind of person who likes to put things out quickly that get into chaos, which is a firefighter. So even that one,
cool.
But you know, what's funny is he looked at the lifestyle of a firefighter. He actually talked to some of my clients who are retired firefighters. He looked at the pay scale of a firefighter and said, I'm not so sure that's where I want to plant my legacy or my feet. And yet that doesn't mean that his desire since he was a little kid was wrong. It actually, he loves what he does as our billing manager, and he loves being able to give people quality service. He told me the other day, I feel so good personally when I'm able to help people get satisfaction when they write to our billing department. That's a really amazing fire starter, especially in a company. I love hearing that when someone's in their role. So isn't that cool how even that thing can play out, as opposed to you know, playing with fires all day? Maybe you're designed to create something differently and not become an arsonist. But, you know, those desires.
Yeah,
when I was little, I was teaching. And so I was 8 years old, and for Christmas I got a teacher's chalkboard that was like 10 feet by 5 feet, a real teacher's chalkboard. And I used to set out dolls and teddy bears, and I would create fake papers to check. And there are pictures of me when I was little. I should find one and put it on my blog, of standing in front of a chalkboard, and I wanted to be a teacher when I was 6, 7, 8 years old.
Wow. That's so neat. Funny, I have pictures of when I was a kid, and I put it up on my Facebook recently, of playing a guitar. And I didn't play at the time. It was bought for me by a family member. And then I literally started 10 years later actually playing. And even though it's a pastime, I play gigs, I play in clubs, I have CDs out. And it's so funny how, you know, I was holding that guitar and probably said at the time, I want to be a rock star at 8 years old, and how
Isn't
it still played
fun?
A part in everything I do.
Yeah.
So you mentioned with him being a fireman, there was probably sentiments of that, his passion in there. And just like with me with the guitar there. So it's kind of neat how that works. And you mentioned another key thing, you know, the idea that just because we don't plan for something to happen doesn't mean it might not become our legacy overall. We had Jack Canfield on the show not that long ago, and Jack, you know, 40 years old, put out the first Chicken Soup for the Soul with Mark
Graham.
Yeah, and I mean, just the idea that people say, oh, once you're a certain age, that's, you know, you already should have found your legacy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if that was the case, we wouldn't have hundreds of millions of copies of the Chicken Soup for the Soul book out inspiring people. I mean,
I think
his story actually, I think, inspires people that they can still, you know, start a new dream at an older age, which is so cool.
Absolutely.
So to shift gears a bit, Sandy.
Here's a picture for you. When I was little, I have to find this picture. Oh, my gosh. When I was little, one of the pictures that my mom had framed and had on the wall was of me in a dress in the sandbox with a John Deere tractor with long blonde hair and a Band-Aid on my chin. There's a little silk over steel for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was
no,
a revolutionary then.
Well, you know, you're going to have to find some of those pictures, because you know those will be big tractions on the site. A lot of people will want to comment on those pictures.
Aren't they going to be fun? Like, who else would wear a dress in a sandbox? Sandy would. She wears pink hair.
No, absolutely. And by the way, that from a branding perspective, that's one of the things that I noticed right away. I'm sure everybody mentions, but your hair, from a branding point of view, I always remembered exactly who you were once I first got onto your Facebook page. Your hair definitely stood out, which is a cool thing.
Would you want to hear where it came from?
Sure, absolutely.
It had nothing to do with branding. I was writing copy for a makeup company, and I was doing my research on other makeup companies and stumbled across one of my favorite makeup companies, MAC Cosmetics, and one of their hairstylists in the video on YouTube, and at that time I had real short hair, had a pink stripe in the front of her hair and blonde and brown, and is, you know, quick action person that I am, I was like, oh, my gosh, I love that. I want to try that. So the next day I got it done. And within 6 months, people were calling me the pink-haired marketer.
Wow.
Within a year, I began to hear, I will never forget you because of that. And what was so interesting is I actually even was teaching one of my coaching classes yesterday, and I said, I wasn't out there copying someone. I wasn't out there trying to be another pink-haired person. It was purely driven by what I thought was cool and I thought would look pretty on me. And yet, it became the thing that people remembered me for, and it actually really demonstrates and, you know, exemplifies the vibrance that God created me to carry. And so it surely is definitely at this point now is a big part of my branding. I actually am talking about it in an upcoming book that I'm writing, and it became a very big part of who I am in the marketplace. But again, it started simply by, like, seeing it in a video and going, oh, I have to have that.
Well, it's, I mean, it's funny because if you were talking what, you know, business strategies early on, I think one of the things that you're mentioning here is the fact that, like you said, not a lot of it was kind of planned that this is going to be my strategy, but obviously it was meant to occur the way it did, or it wouldn't have happened in
That's
such
it.
A holistic way.
So a long
so cool.
time before I knew, God knew I would have pink hair. And I
was You're just trying to find the day to do it.
Here's the wild thing. Do you want to really laugh? I really feel like for some reason I feel real intuitively that I'm supposed to say this. There's somebody listening that this is going to be a big word for them. About 2 years before I did that and thought it was cool, I had a hairdresser that I went into a salon, and I said, I want, you know, brown, and I want some blonde highlights and some burgundy. Well, she thought, because of the wild nature that she had, the burgundy I meant was pink. And she gave me this big pink stripe in the front of my hair, and I thought, because I went in fixated on the colors I was expecting, because, again, that's a part of my personality. This is what I wanted. That's not what I wanted. And it was brown and blonde with pink, and I had been envisioning burgundy, which is like, you know, dark burgundy. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And I went home and added brown to the burgundy, to the blonde, because or the pink, because I thought it was horrible. And yet 2 years later, I thought, that is the weirdest thing. I ended up putting pink back in my hair. So sometimes people are doing something in business and they, or somebody suggests something or whatever, and they think, are you kidding me? I could never do that. And yet they find themselves a couple years later doing it and loving it. So.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. And, I mean, you mentioned it with social media as well for you. So I have to ask you a question about the social media side of things in terms of growing it to the level that you have. I one of the our other guests on the show who did who grew a large following in the last couple of years as well is Shalene Johnson, and I know you guys connect. I've seen you guys connect on Twitter and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So both of you guys being, you know, moms in business, running successful social media platforms. If you had a couple of tips that you could give people to start with, because I know at the end of the day, based on even the information I get from on your newsletter group, that it's not an overnight thing. It's not a, you know, do it today and everything's going to happen magically tomorrow. But if you had something to tell somebody, here's a couple of strategies to get started, where would you tell them to start?
Well, the first thing that I want you to put, the first thing I want you to put in your business plan is this. Your business plan is not to get a ton of likes. Because I see people all the time with 100,000, 130,000, 200,000 people on their page, and about 10,000 or 9,000 or 6,000 people are talking about this, according to Facebook's demographics and according to their analytics. Here's the issue. The talking about this has a lot to do with connection, with engagement, et cetera. As a matter of fact, one of the biggest mistakes that I see people do is they build a following of 100,000, 130,000 people, and they never talk back. Which means that a ton of people are talking to them, but nobody's talking back. As a matter of fact, their competitors are coming along on their page and directing them over to their page. Or you've got people going on there and saying, are you kidding me? This person's a doofus. And they're not even using their platform like I do, like the front area of an office, where people come and mingle and get to know us as a brand and as a company, ask us real questions, and we answer back. Either myself or a client care rep. And so you really want to be careful that your first strategy is not just to get a bunch of likes, because you actually want to get engagement. So what we teach our clients is if you're getting 5,000 people to connect with you, you want to have at least a 20 to 25% engagement ratio. That means at least 1,500 people should be talking about it with you. At least 15 to 2,000 should be talking about it. As I said in the Forbes article, so many people have said 2 to 4% is normal engagement. I think that's pathetic. And a lot of brands, especially when you see brands who have like a million followers, 5 million, 10 million, what's really sad, and you know, it's a good example of a bad example, is when the main person on that page isn't even talking back. We see that with a lot of brands. We see that with a lot of big authors. We see that with people who have TV shows, et cetera. I believe, and if I were to predict, which I am in the business of predicting, I'll tell you what, I'll give you a prophetic word, that within the next 6 to 12 months, we're going to see some of those brands having a major problem on social media because the consumers won't tolerate it anymore. Because what we need to do is be engaging with people. So your main strategy is to engage. As a matter of fact, all that Facebook is doing, what did they just say about the newsfeed? Their main goal was what? Engagement. And we've been teaching that for the last 1 to 2 years in everything that I've done. Your main goal is not to build a big honking list, as all these internet marketers have said. Your goal is to build a responsive list. Your goal is not to build a big direct mail list so you can tote around and say, yeah, I've got 500,000 people on my email, on my mailing list, direct mail. I don't really care how many people are on your list. How many are responding? How many are actually engaging? How many people, when you send out an email, they stop everything they do to open it because your name was on the send and because your picture's at the top? That's what you want to see on social media. It's really not a whole new social media strategy. It's a strategy that I've been using in all of my companies for the last 17 years, that my goal is to have relationship with you. When I built my first kitchenware business that went to $4.5 million in under 3 years, and I, like, wasn't working with anybody as a mentor, I was basically on my face asking God to teach me how to do this stuff and putting out what basically I figured, you know, goodwill and good fortune together, serving people like I wanted to be served. I said, if it's not in my kitchen, it's not in my store. I didn't know that was good branding. When I would help people and serve people and take the extra time with them, it wasn't because I was thinking it was going to help my ROI, because it was a naturally good thing. If I had a store and an old-fashioned mercantile venue where the, you know, people came in on their horse and buggies, we have Amish around where I live, they would take the time to work with you at the kitchenware you bought. When I brought that to social media, you know, I said we have to take the time for that. Now, unfortunately, you have some people are saying, well, that means you're spending all day. No, try 5 to 10 minutes per hour. 5 minutes per hour works out to be about an hour and a half to 2 hours per day. Any business owner who doesn't have 5 hours per week to spend on social media should be rethinking whether to be a business owner.
Well, guys, there you have it. The latest edition of the Conversations with Passion radio show. This time around, our theme being female leaders, and wow, I think we can all agree that this show was just stacked with a ton of great takeaways. It makes it hard, once again, as always, for me to pick just three, but I'll continue my normal tradition by picking three. So the three takeaways for me from this very show, first of all, from our conversation, it was actually part two of our conversation with Shalene Johnson of Turbo Jam fame, great, in my opinion, a great interview filled with a ton of great content. Big thing I took away from our conversation with Shalene is the importance she places on family and the balance of making her career work around her family rather than the other way around. Even going so far as to say the mentor she picks have to share a similar philosophy. And so I think that's a very powerful message that we can take away from this very show. Second message is the power of realizing the importance of paying it forward for the next generation. With both our conversation with Jessica Bowden of Teens Now Talk and Laura Lee Burgess of Oxford Learning, we talked to both of them about the power of paying it forward and trying to make a difference in the lives of the upcoming generation. We talked to both in great depth about the consequences that can happen if we don't take the efforts of trying to help that next generation, but at the same time, and talked about the challenges within that, but at the same time, talked about the ways that we can actually move the needle forward in helping that next generation. So just two great conversations about the power of paying it forward for the people that are going to be taking over and leading the world in the future. finally, from our conversation with Sandy, what I loved about our conversation is Sandy really talked to the importance of being flexible when it comes to achieving your goals, and realizing that just because you plan for something to be a certain way doesn't mean it's going to work out that way, but it still doesn't mean that the way it works out wasn't meant to be and isn't going to be the way that is going to lead you to your goals and your destination. So just she talked multiple times about how things that happened for her weren't necessarily in the works, they weren't planned or they weren't in the card, but they ultimately led to the person she has become today. So really powerful messages, guys. I hope you enjoyed this episode. And until next time, I'm Corey Poirier.
Well, this is the end of the show. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoy the conversations with these inspiring and driven women. And hopefully you also enjoy the inclusion of some jazz. On Tuesday, April 23rd, Corey will be holding his first personally sponsored public seminar. To learn more about attending this seminar, where he will be revealing the 5-step system for achieving productivity in a world filled with way too many demands for our time, you can email his office at thatspeakerguy@gmail.com and visit www.coreypoirier.com to learn more about Corey. To learn more about the show and to sign up to receive important updates, go to www.conversationswithpassion.com. We'd like to take a moment to send out a big thank you to Zdenko Zurich and the Buyer's Choice Home Inspections, Heidi the Mortgage Broker, Art Fresh Media, and Atlantic Marketing and Appeal. Thanks again for tuning in. On behalf of Corey Poirier, I am Marco Kelly, and this has been Conversations with Passion.